Bonjour, Deborah McGregor from York University, Associate Professor and Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Environmental Justice, and I'd like to welcome you to the Indigenous Environmental Justice Fall Symposium podcast series. Today, I am going to introduce Sylvia Plain from Omgemong First Nation. She's a community ambassador and founder of the Great Lakes Canoe Journey. And she will be speaking on the topic of research in motion. Sylvia Plain was our keynote speaker at the symposium. She is a wonderful, passionate Anishinaabe Kwe who really works hard for the water and sees canoe building also as a way of nation building. Her presentation title, Research in Motion, is very interesting because essentially what she's getting at in her keynote is how to put words and research into action, how to put research into motion. She comments that when often people do research, once it's done on paper, it stops moving. And she's very interested in research continuing to move and act and inform nation building in Indigenous communities. The first part of her podcast, she focuses on the context of her research journey. She talks about how she's inspired by the wonderful and inspirational late grandmother, Josephine Mondawmin, how she was initiated into the canoe journey work through water walks. And then Sylvia decided to take it to the next level and figure out how water governance can also be enacted and exercised through being actually on the water as well as walking around the water. So part of the story that she's going to share today is her research journey, starting off with Grandmother Josephine Mondawmin and water walks to tribal canoe journeys, and then on to the work that Sylvia does herself as a canoe builder as part of efforts to engage in nation building in Anishinaabe communities. This podcast was recorded live at the symposium, and I hope you enjoy listening to Sylvia as much as I did. Jimmy Gwetch.
I'm Sylvia Plain. I'm from Omgenong First Nation. I'm going to walk through my presentation today, but really, I definitely have been thinking about this presentation when I was asked to come, you know, because it's Indigenous environmental justice, or environmental justice is just very broad and very big for everyone to begin with. So to say that I have any answers, I don't. But I can tell you what I've been doing as a contribution to my own family and my community and my nation. And beyond that is, I suppose, a bonus. And I often get to be in classrooms like this in various, law, education, science, environment, all across the board. So I'm very honored to be able to come back to the place where the vision for my project was actually born. And that was really being an undergrad at the University of Toronto. At a very fortunate time when U of T did have Dan McGregor and myself. We were quite the pair. But in my second year, I had actually just finished in 2011 participating in the 2011 Mother Earth Water Walk. And so from that experience, I had an invitation to come back from the community, which was actually in the West Coast and in Washington State. And to correlate with that invitation, Deb had actually approached me and had given me an amazing opportunity to pursue my own research and also in joining her research team at the time. So I think that that really catapulted and really enhanced my overall experience as a student. I feel like I didn't have a typical undergrad experience. I probably had a hybrid of maybe master's as well as, I couldn't really tell you anything about PhD, but I had a hybrid of various experiences, and I'm definitely very grateful for that. So I just want to acknowledge, like there are probably many people in this room that are here because of Deb, what I'm about to share with you is also because of her. And, you know, a lot of really amazing things have happened, but it really takes that one experience, that one opportunity to let someone pursue something that they didn't know was going to grow into something so big and so special. And so I want to acknowledge Deb for that. And so while I'm going to share a story with you today, I remember the last time I was in a very similar room at a conference in, it was at Algoma. It was a youth and elders gathering. And it was actually the last time that I saw Grandmother Josephine. And when I was giving that presentation, when I was thinking about it, when I was putting it together, I was thinking about my story. I knew that I was going to cater it to her. And what is significant about that, and where I'm going to start my story from, because it involves her, is that my research experience in this Great Lakes canoe journey was a promise that I made to her, that this is the work that I will pick up in continuation of the amazing work that you have done and for the ripple effects that you have sent into the future. Because her actions defined how I would move forward in my work. And knowing no matter how big or small I stepped, I knew I wanted to create a ripple effect. And so this story, like I told to Josephine, is also a story to Deb. I'm saying, these are the plants that you have, the seeds that you have planted for me. And this is what I have done while it has grown. And so I was really proud to show her, Josephine, this is what I've done since I made that promise to you. And I haven't seen Deb in a while. And so this is really saying, you gave me this seed and this is what I've done with it. And so as I move forward, I just want to say, maybe your research won't mean as much as it has to me, but I think it's really important to pick something that you're passionate about and something that makes a difference. Because no matter how big or small, it'll make a difference, trust me. Oh, and to explain my leg. So I was teaching at the Native Learning Center here in Toronto, and I went to go play basketball with them and thought I was in high school and was probably feeling the rapper fever. And it all went wrong from there, so. I was hoping that physio would have been enough, but turns out I had to get, I tore my ACL, so. But I'm optimistic about it because I have a lot of paddling to do. I have a lot of baseball left to play, hockey. I'm hoping to take up surfing. I think the waves out on the Toronto beaches are just wasting away and waiting for me. So so this is me. This is the Great Lakes canoe journey. And I guess I'll start from really joining Deb's project. I think everyone, and Deb mostly, we're looking at existing water declarations and documents that were created by our territorial and political organizations. Collaboration of, you know, community members, elders, all levels of learning, people coming together, setting out the best intents for our communities. What happens, as we all know, is that when something goes on a piece of paper, it stops moving. And so Deb's overall quest was really to look at how can we mobilize these really great intents. And like I said, I was pretty new in my journey at that point, but I was very eager. I was very inspired by participating in the Mother Earth Water Walk. And I had a really great teacher to start me off, really. And so I just knew that I had this invitation to go to the West Coast, and that really all that I could really rely on was the teachings that I had been given throughout my life, the values and the ethics taught to me by my elders, by my community. It's really too hard to put my U of T cap on and remember everything that I was taught in whatever 4 months versus something that I had been taught a lifetime. And so that's really what I went out there knowing, that I had something to offer and that I was going into another territory and we were going to exchange. It wasn't that I was going to extract anything. It was that we were truly interested in one another, and that we had something to gain from the things that we had to learn from one another.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Sylvia Plain talk about the context of her work as a canoe builder to support nation building. I really just love Sylvia Plain. She, to me, is just such an inspiration as a young person taking up everything that she has in terms of energy and commitment to supporting youth and future generations, and learning all she can about canoe building and tribal canoe cultures across the world. She began her research at the University of Toronto, and then again it transformed into this work that she does on her own and independently throughout around the world, actually, as she engages in tribal canoe journeys. She's traveled to New Zealand, she's traveled to the West Coast to share her knowledge and learn from others. She thinks about her work as being a form of knowledge exchange in which different nations will learn from each other about canoes and what they can do to help nations recover and revitalize their own governance. The next section of her podcast, I title, "This is Where It All Begins." And this is where Sylvia talks about how there has to be a real commitment to learn from others. You really have to engage in knowledge exchange, and how different nations around the world are working through canoe building and canoe journeys in order to share knowledge that some nation might have and another nation may not have, but enables collective nation building around the world. She talks about how canoe journeys via waterways is one way that we can recognize each other as nations, and also how we can recognize and respect water as also being an important form of governance. I hope you enjoy this next section.
And so this is really where it begins, you know, having conversations, sitting at U of T with Deb and really eager to go out to what I had just learned about, this tribal canoe journeys. And at least what I had known in my research journey was that I knew what I knew, what was going on in my territory, that I wanted to go out and really learn from what other nations, indigenous nations, were doing in terms of managing their lands and waters and what they were doing to mobilize the people in their communities. And it just so happened that the tribal canoe journeys was an amazing model, something that inspired me to commit to see grow here. And so that's what I knew. Those are the tools that I had in my bundle. And I knew that I was going out with a bunch of other Anishinaabe people. I think that was also really unique about that experience. I wasn't just by myself. The exchange took place with other Anishinaabe people from what is now Canada and the United States. So we had a diverse representation for the Anishinaabe people going out there. And so being new, we all had questions. We were all vulnerable. This was all new to us. We went there with good hearts and good minds, and we knew. We went with our gifts from our territories. That's all that we really knew. But little did we know what we would be shown. And so that's the context of how this all started, was working with Deb, joining her team, and just really having a passion for contributing to my nation, to people like Deb and our leaders that have been contributing, and wanting to help alleviate that or help where else, so they can focus on maybe what their strengths are. So from the canoe journey, from the water walk, we started in Skokomish. What's also really unique about this experience is that it was also very historical. It was the first time that the Anishinaabe people had ever participated in the travel canoe journeys in modern times. So us to be out there was also about nation building. It was about building relationships between nations that hadn't visited each other via waterways in a really long time. And so this is actually the canoe that we built. And we actually gifted this to the tribe that had invited us to come, because we understood and we understand the significance of that relationship. So this is the canoe that we paddled in. Maybe I'll start from there to just explain that over this. So this is really the starting out with Deb and going out to the canoe journeys, really opened my eyes up to canoes. But throughout the rest of my undergrad experience, I also had the opportunity to travel in different parts of the world and to be exposed to the canoe cultures amongst the indigenous nations that I traveled to. And so that's what these pictures are from. So there were a lot of things throughout my journey that influenced me and really kept me on track with canoes and overall canoe culture. And so these are canoes, dugout canoes, on a Mayan beach in a fishing village in Belize. I put these other pictures down here because there's other activities that we participated in. But why are they there? Because they correlate with canoes. As I've started out working on water governance and water management, the canoe is just so vast into our everyday lives and connecting people worldwide that we are just uncovering things all the time. And so you think about chocolate or corn. When I went to New Zealand, I went there to go study the Whanganui River. At that time, the legislation was in its third reading in the House. And so I was there, was able to spend time with communities along the Whanganui River. But it just so turned out the people I was living with, they were the chiefs of the world's biggest waka, which is kind of a hereditary leadership for this particular canoe. And for historical facts, this is the only canoe that is a part of the British naval fleet. They can hoist a British flag should they be called on. When I was also there, I got to paddle and sail in different kinds of canoes, but also to meet different kinds of canoe builders. So double hulls, single hulls, you know, reed canoes, all kinds of different canoes. So this really, like, as you can tell from these experiences. And then of course, connecting back to food. A friend of mine from New Zealand is doing her PhD on the migration of the sweet potato. So traveling from Peru to New Zealand, becoming a staple in their diet. And of course, you can't, how else would it get there in those instances? It's the canoe. The canoe has connected us all, but some canoes have only mattered more than others, fortunately. Oh, and then of course, this is another one. I don't know if you guys have read, this is a quinoa that was discovered in Brantford. It's like thousands of years old. Comes from Peru, but was cultivated by the Haudenosaunee in Brantford. How did it get here? By foot or canoe. Maybe an animal, I don't know, maybe a donkey, I don't know. Do we have donkeys here? I don't know. But we're asking those questions. These things is like, I'm like, okay, I just did water research, but now I'm like, it keeps spinning us off. So this is where we're at. This is how vast it really is. And so getting back to tribal canoe journeys, this is us coming up to shore, asking permission at the, this is actually at Port Angeles, which is at the southern point of the Puget Sound, asking permission to come ashore. This would have been the traditional territories of the Squaxin people. That's where the canoe journeys were held. And so this is where I start asking questions. I start realizing, well, I have never in my lifetime have seen anybody in our communities ask permission to come ashore to anybody else's territories. I've never seen anybody stand there when I've arrived. Not that I've actually paddled there. But, you know, this was really beautiful. This was really amazing. So all, and when we paddled into each of the territories, there were canoe families from that community there making sure that we were safe. You know, we acknowledge you, we receive you, come share our food, dances, maybe trade men and women. I don't know. There was definitely what we call snagging going on. Because one guy did joke, actually we did, it was John. We pulled up, we were practicing our protocol, and he just said, hey, you know, we want to trade, we'll take some of your women and you can take our strongest men. And that was our practice before we actually got to this really nice point here. So there is humor in all of this, I think, as we understand that we're learning as people trying to bring this canoe culture back. We're learning from other nations, but we're also being able to laugh at ourselves. Growing in hopefully the safest way possible, because it is very hard.
I hope you enjoyed Sylvia sharing some of the many hard lessons that she's learned, but at the same time, very rewarding lessons that she's learned as part of her rebuilding or revitalizing journey for and through canoe building. She talked about how everyone is learning the new, like, what protocols there might be for landing in other people's territories. So she talked about how sometimes you just have to have fun. It's extraordinarily hard work, but you also have to have fun. And it's also really important to have a sense of humor. So I hope you enjoy listening to Sylvia's stories about some of the journey that she's been on. In this next section, she talks about where did the canoes go. She feels that canoes are a part of the living history of Canadian and Indigenous relations, that canoes should have their proper role in understanding history and the role of history in the building of Canada. She talks about how the economy was built upon the canoe. She says that the canoe is a great place to start to tell the story of Canada, because that's one that Canada cannot deny. As we know, a lot of Indigenous history is absent in what's taught in schools, and learning about the canoe and its role in building Canada and perhaps contributing to our understanding of appropriate Indigenous-led reconciliation might be one place to start for the appropriate role of the canoe. So listen to Sylvia talk about the role of canoe in history. Chimiigwech.
And of course, being exposed to all this, we're asking questions, well, where did our canoes go? Because we were, when people got here, and the first story of Canada really has everything to do with canoes. The Canadian economy was built by canoes. Towns and cities, the distances that were traveled were birch bark canoes. When Europeans first landed on the eastern shores, the people that knew the waterways, that knew where to hunt, where to trap, how to get around, the first Cadillac of the Great Lakes is the birch bark canoe. And we were really written out of that history. I remember reading history books in elementary school. It was like, there was these European dudes with like cool hats on, and there was like, I don't know, the Voyager canoe, and I think they mentioned Métis, and then there was Canada. It was like, there's this beautiful canoe built. It's a masterpiece of the Anishinaabe people, really. I couldn't tell you when it was first invented, but when it has never been really perfected since the day that it was complete. It's perfect in every way possible. That has also been something that I have come to learn throughout this, but of course, going through these experiences, asking questions, where did all this go? I can tell you a lot of our canoes are in Peterborough. They're probably in museums in Britain. They're probably in private collections. Your grandparents might even have one. And I'll buy it for like $200. Because that did actually happen. Someone had a canoe, an old canoe, in their garage, and someone had put in, I don't know, they had painted something over it to the point where you couldn't actually tell that it was a birch bark canoe. So when they went to go sell it and they got it in our hands, we realized that it was a birch bark canoe. They literally sold it to us for $500. If you have it, use it. If you're not going to use it, give it back to another community. Don't put it in a museum. It's the worst thing you can do. So this is Josephine and I, again, from the Mother Earth Water Walk, and we were both, many of us actually, were asked to come back, and so we did actually go. And so I had the opportunity to spend with her, and she was able to witness that, see these other people, this different nation, govern their waters in a different way through a very strong canoe culture, and that's out in the Pacific Northwest. It's not in one particular region, it's the whole Pacific Northwest, and it's growing. That's some amazing governance. You don't see Canada or the United States do that. But these guys come together annually via canoes to renew their relationships and their roles and responsibilities to each other, because that's what they've always done. And so it was from that conversation, and that's why I'm just showing, here's Josephine and Awaka. Nobody has ever really seen that picture. It was through all of these experiences that, you know, we had had that conversation. Many of us, many Anishinaabe women were there to say, we need to do this. We need to bring this back home. And we had had a private conversation, and she had asked me following that meeting, do you think people will really follow up? Do you think they'll really do this? I said, I don't know. I said, I have to do, actually. I think they will. You know, I said, but I'll do it. I can. I can do that right now. I'll do that. That's what I can commit to. And so that's really that continuation. And so that's why I want to say that I'm happy to come here, because this is really the roots of it. And thinking about something I haven't mentioned, which is my own community. Omgenang is in the middle of 63 petrochemical plants. Like the canoe started the Canadian economy, so did the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe people. The people of Omgenang, the first place to strike oil in Canada, was in our traditional territories. And then the largest refinery in North America grew around our territories. So we have a lot to say about the foundation of this country. And so that's why the canoe is a really great place to start to tell that story, because it's one that Canada doesn't deny. They just haven't really talked about it completely. And it doesn't matter whether you're a part of that old history of Canada or you're new to this country, your canoe and your knowledge is valuable and can contribute to this country. The two-row wampum, which we'll get into actually, the 400th anniversary of the two-row wampum was in 2013. And so this is actually the Haudenosaunee leadership called together a paddle from Onondaga to Manhattan to celebrate the treaty that was made between the Haudenosaunee and the Dutch to establish Manhattan and New York. And so we paddled. I was working for Chiefs of Ontario at the time, and I was able to go. And Sue and JC actually joined me, and another guy, Derek Jackson from Oquemecong, we all paddled. And this is how we paddled in two rows. That was the idea. That is the idea. If you ever see the two row and you ever wonder, it's really two canoes. It's there, it's whatever, the European ship, and it's the Haudenosaunee canoe. You're to paddle side by side, to never cross over one another. You can live in this place, and we can share, and we can be in peace and friendship, but don't ever try to cross over. Well, one side has done that, and this is where we're at. But it's really built into that. And so, again, here we are with the canoes, enacting out something that I think even in universities are even guilty about talking about things as if they haven't had happened in modern times. We talk about them like they're way back when. You probably have only ever heard about the two-row wampum as if it was way back in the day. Well, this was celebrated not long ago. It is live and well. The protocols are intact. And beyond us paddling during this anniversary, there was a delegation that continued on to the Netherlands. So this is how we paddled every day. The Haudenosaunee, when they called on this canoe journey down the Hudson River, they also built their own dugout canoe. And so you see this ripple effect but of Indigenous nations being inspired by those canoe cultures that were left intact, that are fortunate, or they held on, they fought. Maybe their struggle was hard, but they fought hard and they held on to it. We're learning from them. And so it was really amazing to see that for the Haudenosaunee people, the Stugout canoe being born and seeing them paddle. And very similar to the Mother Earth Water Walk, I rarely ever travel through a territory without the original people of that land. And so paddling through the Haudenosaunee and Lenape territories, we have representatives from both nations take us right into Manhattan. And so this is really what a daily view would have looked like. For me, I had actually never been to New York City. I had never been to Manhattan. And so this is the first way that I went, the same way that my ancestors would have. This is our crew, so we paddle with every day. Allies and friends of the Haudenosaunee people, the Confederacy, representatives of the Anishinaabeg Nation that went. And this is how many people paddled from all over the world every single day. We camped in different towns along the way, and it was an opportunity to talk about what is a treaty, what is a wampum, what is the significance of this anniversary, why are we doing it in this way? So it was really amazing, again, as a young person to see that, you know, it's not something that's stuck in the past, it's something that is talked about in modern times. Our governance is in place. This is an act of that. This is an exchange of gifts and smoking a pipe between different Haudenosaunee leaders. Orrin Lyons, you see there, the faith keeper, with that's a Dutch consul general based out of New York there, representing the Dutch people there. So this has all been going on, you know, through all these experiences. And so, of course, you know, in traveling, I was very eager to come back. And I think I was really committed after I came back to that. You know, like I said, I had that opportunity from Deb. And then, you know, I was just really committed through those experiences to come back to say that this is what I, in addition to the promise, the very important promise that I made to Josephine, these are the commitments. And so in 2014, I had the opportunity through a partnership with the Mizwepik Aboriginal Employment Training to provide employment and a canoe building opportunity to 5 youth that are living and based in the city of Toronto. Indigenous youth from different nations. 2 of them are Anishinaabe, 1 is Haudenosaunee, and Michael is Mi'kmaq. And so when we do our work, we also try to spread our knowledge out to other nations that we know that build birch bark canoes as well. It's not just about concentrating the knowledge in one particular area. We want to spread that out. I mean, it's important, you know? It's important not just for what we want to achieve as a project, but for the environment, our engagement with the trees and getting people out in the land and making observations and collecting visual data, really, about their territories and activating the local knowledge. I'd say that's pretty valuable. It's important to spread the knowledge. So these are the students. I was very fortunate that they were able to be employed. That's been a goal of ours, and we've been successful with that throughout every project that we've had. And so, you know, this is them. They finished building the canoe and they were able to travel around Toronto, really just, you know, it was their moment of pride to show, like, hey, we're still here and this is the original canoe. And so I was happy. That was their moment. That was really about, that was for them. Where's Lawrence? You. So we've been doing all these really cool things. We did this canoe here in Toronto. And I always come back. I always go back to my community, my chief and council, and I say, hey, this is what I'm up to. You know, sometimes they, you know, well, they usually do support me. Sometimes they give me cash or whatever. But I, you know, say, hey, what's up? And so I just said, you know, like, I have this vision. I just came back from the West Coast. This is what I want to do. You know, maybe it'll be in an X amount of years. We can do something, a canoe journey here in our region between maybe 1 or 2 communities. They called me back a few months later and said, hey, like, we organized a water walk and paddle between 4 different communities, Stony Point, Cattle Point, Omgenong, and Wapul. And so this is what we did, and that's what these pictures are. And so this just happened shortly after we built the canoe here in Toronto. That's actually where the students in the picture that I just showed you. So this is us paddling. So it was a really great opportunity for us to visit each other, to learn about our own territories, to exchange gifts, for leadership to have conversations with one another. There's all of these really beautiful things that are embedded when we do these canoe journeys. And so this is really different. And so that's why I was pointing out Laurence here. She's that's her in this picture. Just want to point it out and see you. She, it was crazy. None of us knew what to expect. We got into a crazy thunderstorm, and so it was great to have her there and to be a part of that, because that's everything that I'm sharing with you. Everyone has really been there through our journey and through our growth. And so it's always really great to see people in the crowd that have been there to say, hey, you know, like, I was there. This picture here is us asking permission to come ashore. That's my cousin, who's the chief, some of my family members. And so that was possible. To see that, something that I thought was going to happen in a few years, and to see it happen right away was really meaningful for me. And so, of course, all of these things encouraged me to continue to go on, to see this, that people were really reacting to this work. This is, yay, we got to Waffle Island. So I was finally able to come home and build a canoe in my community. I traveled all over the place, but of course, as I'm going all over, I'm always thinking about being home and wanting to provide that opportunity for my own community members. I'm not gonna go into too much about this. There were some really positive things, but there were also really negative things about this experience. But the positive things were is that, you know, we were able to, you know, these are kids from the daycare with their teachers. This is their class time. This is them learning about their culture. This is them touching and feeling and smelling. And we were able to give a lot of materials for them to go home later in their classroom to make different crafts and stuff like that. So we were also able to make paddles with my grandpa, which is really cool. He's always really excited to help out and contribute wherever he can. So this is him with our scouts program in Omdrenong, them learning how to make paddles from him.
Sylvia talked about the important role of canoes in the living history of Canada. I really appreciate how she talks about canoes as having an important part of understanding Canadian history and Indigenous, non-Indigenous relations, how canoes are meant to be used, and being on the water, they're not meant to be sitting in a museum, that's actually not respectful of the canoe. So to me, this represents an Indigenous understanding of history. It's not linear. It's more of an embodied living sense of connecting the past to the present, to the future. I think the canoe is one way to embody this really wonderful way of thinking about history. One example that she gave in her piece was the 400th anniversary of the Two-World Wampum and paddling down the Hudson River with different nations. I thought was a wonderful way to show that treaty relations, these important kind of nation-to-nation relations, are not just history. In the next section, which I think about is being called Knowing the Land, where she talks about her transition from university-based research as an undergraduate student, engaging in experiential learning, to the Anishinaabe University of the Land, learning and exchanging knowledge also with the non-human worlds, other beings in creation, other beings and entities, and approaching that with humility, because there's a lot to learn from other living beings in the world. She talks about her efforts at canoe building is getting people on the land. This is one way to activate the memories of the ancestors and elders. They just remember what it's like, and they remember their knowledge a lot more when they're actually getting to live on the land. She talks about how canoe building can also support justice for communities by getting people of all ages out on the land, learning and sharing that intergenerational learning is possible through canoe building. She's able to work with people of all ages, right down from daycare to youth to collaborations at the university level with Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. So Sylvia's really expanded her work as a canoe builder, and not only supporting nation building, but better and more healthy relations between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. I hope you enjoy the next section.
I'm pretty tired. This is my off season. This is my downtime to think about how we're going to approach the next season, thinking about the, and this is what's also really great. This work has really transitioned me out of the university, which didn't entirely make me feel good, but going into an Anishinaabe university, which makes me feel whole and complete. Interacting with non-humans, but these other living beings, and being humbled by them, and following natural law the way that it was really set out. And to me, that means that I am governed by the seasons, by the land. My work is seasonal. It tells me when I can and cannot work. And so being conscious of, you know, keeping stock, knowing the land. And so what's been really cool about us, you know, we worked in Omgenang. This picture is us last summer in Shawanaga First Nation, just north of Parry Sound. This is probably where the birch line starts for healthy canoe trees. Being mobile like this gives us an opportunity to really take account of the stock that we have in our Anishinaabeg territories, which is really cool. Seeing it in an intimate way that maybe not even the environment department doesn't engage in that way. So we're getting people out on the land. We're attaching like that intergenerational learning. So activating the memories of the elders and them saying, hey, like I remember when I was a little boy, my grandfather might have been the last guy that built a canoe in our community. They don't remember everything, but they remember parts. And that activation is like a library that's been dormant, that has this spirit just like jumped right into them. That's what it means to put an Anishinaabe person back out on the land. So we're learning about that, and we're learning about climate change, actually. What was my point about that is that they're talking about this is how thick the bark used to be when I was younger. These are the things that used to grow on the tree when I was younger. These are the things that have been sprayed at this age, and these are the things that have been impacted. All of these things we're all hearing through every community that we work through. So we're starting to see those things. This is JC's mom. Sue, where is she? Sue, she's not here. She's probably not here because she knows her color out. But this is, so some of the things I'm showing you through the bark, giving you an idea of the type of thickness. This is from this summer. This is the spruce sap that we harvest. We use that as glue to sew up the roots. This is a root system, spruce root system in Garden River. We use that as string to tie our canoes. That's just really the steps, and that's the final product from root to splitting to finally weaving. So in addition to that, we're starting to get into the technology part, and that just kind of inherent. It was just built right into it. So starting to look at different tree fibers. So not only when we started doing the canoe stuff, it was like, wow, okay, we need to plant more birch trees because if we want to build more birch bark canoes, that's what we need. And we need to start looking into the types of environments that they need to be in to thrive. We need to think about those future generations. In addition to that, looking at the other types of trees that we use to make our technology, our baskets, our rope, our knives, our sails, our mats, those are all really important. And so we're being pointed all of these things. This is basswood. It's not so much about this picture, it's about the thing that the rope that's holding up this bark. We've definitely harvested the materials for this, but that's something that we can do in the off season to learn how to make this rope. Cedar, getting into weaving cedar using that material. I like to call this like Anishinaabe daycare. This is what we like let our little kids do. but this little girl here, she's actually really awesome. She just has a natural feel for splitting. It's actually went a lot thinner than that. That's a sheathing that goes under the ribs. That covers the bark on the base of the canoe there. So, but we like to teach young kids, of course, with their parents' supervision. We let them do these things. It's really natural to them to say, don't do this and don't do that, is to kill their curiosity, for them to make mistakes and to learn from them, to explore what are their own strengths. We do not limit that as Anishinaabe people. Starting to get into looking into harvesting plants and medicines, looking at what dyes the different materials. is another element that we're going to be getting into. We did test it at the Native Learning Center in the fall, or the start of the spring, and that did work. And this, yeah, just really training young people. You know, that's him. He made his own mallet. He split out the cedar. He harvested the cedar. And to me, like, this is like really positive for the future. This is justice for our communities, teaching these young people how to do this. Getting into technology, this is a workshop that we did last spring here in Toronto, and again in partnership with Mizwebi Aboriginal Employment and Training, as well as the University of Toronto. They funded us to actually make the tools to build a birch bark canoe. And so, where's JC? She knows how to make those tools in case anybody needs them. So we're spreading that out. We're spreading that knowledge out. There's other people from different communities. As you can tell, none of those students have been a part of my program before. So we need people that know how to make these knives. And so, of course, we're training people along the way. And just last year, last summer, a group of us went back out to Tribal Canoe Journeys again to participate, to show our friendship, to show that really this is what we have been doing in the meantime since we've been here, since you really inspired us to build something in our home territories. And so I wanted to show these pictures here because to me there's a lot of really positive things that are going on, as you could tell really from that journey. But one really cool thing was JC's dad's actually, he's an arborist. And so we were up in Garden River. I was up there really living there for 2 months building this canoe. Well, we didn't actually find the tree. We've been harvesting other materials. So hopefully I'm sure we'll find it in the spring. But anyways, he's an arborist, so he has an access to all these trees when he goes out. People call him, hey, I need this cut down, I need whatever, this and that. So he goes. And so he called me a couple of times this year, and he said, hey, I'm going out. This property has, like, this huge birch tree. You should come check it out. And I just thought, I was like, when I went there, I was like, that's so cool. I was like, imagine this happen all the time. Not that I want, my phones would probably be, I need, like, a call center, actually. I'm stressed just thinking about it. But imagine that this happened. Imagine some of you have family members that are arborists or who work for the tree services or whomever for the city. And you could call me and you say, hey, I have this tree. Because what had happened here is that we were able to take the bark off of there. And while we might not be able to use it for a birch tree, someone can use it for baskets. Someone can use it for earrings. Someone that has mobility issues and can't get out on the land, we're thinking of them, and this is an opportunity. This is us accessing resources that were ours to begin with, that belong to Garden River. And so every time, like, I fell, I was like, this is justice. Like, I'm getting this tree, you know, because it was really land that was just kind of taken anyway. So it feels good to be able to go and to do that, because what I also realized, you know, they would have just, like, chipped it up. So I went and they cut it up in blocks, and I was able to go, and I actually sat there in the dirt and I harvested every single one of those chunks, and I got tons of bark from it. And I was actually able to give it to some people that actually work with birch bark. And so the same goes for, like, cedar here. I'll show you this. The cedar here, same as for arborists. They just cut up the cedar tree, take whatever they can off of it. But if you take the outer bark off, and you know how to clean it properly, well, we can use that for all types of crafts and weaving. Imagine every arborist did that across Canada, the stock supply we'd have to make crafts and to build an economy. That's, I would say, an act of reconciliation. It's small, but I think it really matters. The same goes for the tree sap. This tree sap right here is actually the best place to harvest it is in the city, because they're constantly being groomed. And so those cuts that are actually in there enables the sap to come and cluster up, so we can actually go and just pick it out very easily like that. And so my friends and I actually do drive around the city, or we bike around the city looking for sap in the city of Toronto. I have enough to put on a canoe. I harvest it all from the city of Toronto. So if you do see me up in the tree, it really is me. It's me and my friends. But what's really hard sometimes is that when we're riding around and we see, I'll see this like huge piece of sap on the other side of a fence, and I'm like, oh, like, you know, that I wouldn't have to go further. I could just, you know, and I feel tempted to knock on the door. I feel like I could just reach it. Like, maybe I'll go buy a long spoon or something. Like, my friends and I have talked about, like, doing a night mission, like, wearing all black and, like, putting a bucket in front of our bikes. Like, come on, can you guys help me out, please? Like, so little things like that. I'm sure you will go home today. If you see a spruce tree, I guarantee you there's some sap on it. Put it in a jar, you know? Or maybe you can, it's actually, there has a lot of uses. But think about, you know, we don't just bring like little baby jars and go drop it out of Six Nations every other week. Like, bring a whole bunch, like at one point. And the, you know, like there's little things that we can do, you know? I've tried to do what I can in the city. I've tried to explore that as someone that grew up on the reserve, and but try to make a space, to find a place for the kids that don't live on the reserve. I would say, you know, okay, fine, there is some green space. I have to say that. I think that there have been some people that have cared that haven't solely introduced foreign invasive species just because it looks nice, but have tried to keep things natural and indigenous the way that they were. That'd be cool. That's another request. So that's where we're at, really. You know, I think I've made good time. I think I have. But that's really where we've been. That's how far we've come since the beginning of, from the Mother Earth Water Walk to working with Deb. You know, being honest with you, there's negative experiences and there is a disposition, I'm being honest. It is because, you know, it could be very simple about just be yourself when you show up somewhere. Don't be invasive. Don't be extractive. Think about what you were taught and offer that. People will respect you for that, though. They'll respond to you that way, you know. Moving forward in your research, you don't have to do what I've done. I never really imagined that this would be turned into a business, but it has. And I feel very fortunate to be able to wake up and do what I love, to continue to learn, to be an Anishinaabe, to be a teacher. That's something that I'm actually learning how to do and following other speakers and teachers and what are their methods and what is very effective. That's very important to me. That's something I didn't realize that I would have to do in this journey, but I've accepted it. And so just remember, no matter what you do in your research, just think about that responsibility to yourself, your community. Maybe it is your school, I don't know. But the future generations, and that you can be effective. You know, like I said, I didn't know that this was going to turn into a business, but it is. And we have a lot of goals moving forward, you know, through a combination of all of the things that I have been doing. Our vision now is to have our own building, to have our own canoe building school. Maybe it'll be a canoe building and technology center where we're teaching people how to weave and, you know, of course, you know, there's food navigation and there's star navigation. It's so big, but at least we want to create a center of learning for Anishinaabe people, but also to encourage Indigenous peoples from around the world really to come and learn, to exchange with us, to talk about those other trade routes that happened and took place between us, because not all trade stories were negative. The Chinese buttons on Haida blankets, that was a West Coast trade that nobody talks about. Haida Gwaii people have these blue beads that come from Russia. You go to Belize, they talk about the Mali people from Africa that didn't come and conquer. Those are positive canoe stories. And I think that those are really important as we move forward. Whether you join me on this or not, I encourage all of you really to look at your own roots and whether, however you contribute, whatever your passion and strength is moving forward, to carry that, that's your bundle. Those are your seeds. Those are your roots. And so that's how I walk, because I don't know how to be anything different. And so this is my commitment to my people. And I just want to say thank you for listening. And to encourage you all to just continue what you're doing and to thank you for being in this room, because I know you're in this room because we're all like-minded, but you sat here and listened, even through the hard things, that you're the those people that are going to make a difference. And we're all really kind of united by this great woman here. So again, wanting to say thank you to Deb, because none of this would be possible without really the seed that she planted for me. So thank you.
Sylvia's work comes back full circle. A lot of her inspiration is really motivated by putting the spirit back into our knowledge, by activating, by acting on knowledge, by putting it in motion, as she talks about with canoe building. She's really committed to bringing knowledge back to the youth and to the kids. I really feel inspired by how, in an urban context, being able to support canoe building through building materials and building tools is possible, and that everyone can learn through collaborations. Sylvia is committed to continue to seek knowledge, to support canoe building. I appreciated how she talked about how you have to have so much other knowledge. That star knowledge for navigation becomes really important. Food becomes really important because you can transport food through canoe, and that medicines knowledge is also really relevant and important as part of canoe building. She looks at it from a very holistic point of view, which I believe she was able to convey beautifully in her discussion. So to conclude, Sylvia's contribution as a keynote is always inspiring. I don't know if you're ever going to meet anyone who's got so much passion and so much knowledge and is so clever, I find, and smart in terms of how she can convey it to so many people and for it to have meaning. So I really hope that you enjoyed listening to her as much as I did. This podcast forms a part of a series from the 2019 Fall Indigenous Environmental Justice Symposium that was held at York University in November. And more on the different podcasts can be found at the Indigenous Environmental Justice Project. Website is iejproject.info.yorku.ca. So thank you for listening. Chimigwech.